Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
None of us may ever come face to face with our own capacity for inhumanity unless something completely unexpected were to happen, like, say, driving home from a night partying with friends. Most of us aren't capable of allowing the suffering and especially the death of another. But there are some people that will do most anything in order to keep their secrets and bad deeds hidden so that they don't have to suffer any consequences. This is a tale about the choices that were made one dreadful day in the early morning hours of October 26, 2001. The city of Fort Worth is the fifth largest city in Texas and the 13th largest in the whole United States. It is estimated that the population is nearly 1 million as of the 2019 census. American Idol and Grammy Award winner Kelly Clarkson was born there, as was Taylor Hawkins, drummer for the rock and roll band The Foo Fighters. A woman you will be hearing a lot about in this case, Shantae Jawan Mallard, was also born in Fort Worth on June 22, 1976. She was the youngest of three children and the only girl. She was quiet, reserved, and well-mannered. All three of the kids are said to have been spoiled by their parents, John and Dorothy. When Shantae graduated from high school, her parents bought her a small yellow house in Fort Worth. Shantae worked as a CNA in an elderly care facility, and by 2001, she had been in this line of work for 7 years. Shantae finished her shift at 10 p.m. on the night of October 25th, 2001. Partying was on her mind after a long night's work. Her best friend, Talisi Fry, called T for short, and Shantae had previously made the plan to go to Joe's Big Bamboo Club in Arlington. Shantae drove home first to pick up her clothes, then headed to T's apartment. While there, Shantae had a drink and the two split an ecstasy tablet. Shantae would later testify in court that this was the second time she had ever taken ecstasy. The first time she took an entire tablet and claimed it had no effect on her. Shantae changed into her party clothes and the two got into Shantae's 1997 gold Chevrolet Cavalier at approximately 11:30 for the 20-minute drive. They were each sipping on a cocktail while splitting a marijuana joint on their way to the club. After being at the bar for between 15 to 30 minutes, Shantae described herself as feeling loose and out of control, attributing it to the ecstasy tablet she took at T's house. Nevertheless, she consumed between 2 to 4 drinks and smoked a marijuana joint with friends at the bar. T and Shantae exited the club at the closing time of 2 a.m. T was holding on to Shantae's keys for her, and they both made their way out to the car. They lingered a few minutes socializing until around 2:30 a.m. Shantae then got into the driver's seat and drove a few feet before T told her to stop, that she was incapable of driving. T then drove the two to her apartment, and even though Shantae and her were best friends, Shante didn't ask if she could stay the night. She testified in court it was because she knew that T had plans to meet somebody early that morning. Shante, still feeling the effects of the ecstasy, got behind the wheel of her car and left T's apartment to drive towards her home, a 20 to 25 minute drive. She entered 287 North, which is a curve right before the freeway exit, Village Creek, going the speed limit of 50. According to her testimony, which you will hear later on in this episode, all of a sudden something hit her car. There was a loud noise and wind was blowing into the car and glass was flying everywhere, cutting at her skin and stinging her. She took the Village Creek exit, then realized that there was a man stuck headfirst in her windshield, with his face touching the floorboard of her car. Shante pulled over and stopped her car at the Village Creek exit. She got out, went to the passenger side, and looked at Gregory Biggs, the man who was stuck in the windshield. She touched his leg, and according to her, she was shocked and scared. She got back into her car and drove towards her home. Shante testified that she heard a moan coming from Mr. Biggs, indicating that he was still alive and possibly conscious at this time. Shante navigated her way to her home, managed to locate the opener where she pulled into the garage, at which time she closed the door. When Shante entered the house from the garage around 3:30 a.m., she immediately called T and asked her to come pick her up. While awaiting T's arrival, she periodically went into the garage and spoke to Mr. Biggs, apologizing for hurting him and telling him she didn't mean to. She also told him that she didn't know what to do. There are disputes about whether Mr. Biggs was conscious at this time. Shante claims he tried to speak to her, but she couldn't make out what he was saying. When T arrived at Shante's house, she jumped into the car and through screaming and crying, told T to drive. Shante borrowed T's phone and was frantically trying to reach somebody. Shante called Vaughn. While on the phone, T was trying to find out what had happened. Shante finally pulled herself together enough to tell T that she hit a white guy and that she didn't mean to do it. She also stated that the body was still in the garage. Meanwhile, they arrived to their destination, which was Terrence's house, an on-again, off-again boyfriend of Shante's. Shante exited the car and went to the door, but nobody answered. After failing to find Terrence and get a hold of Vaughn, they drove back to Shante's house. The two entered the home through the front door. Shante went into the bedroom, and T went into the garage through the kitchen. She saw the backside of Mr. Biggs' partially unclothed body sticking out of the windshield. T claims she told Shante to call 911. Shante disputes this claim. Neither of them called 911. Shante didn't want to stay at her house, so T drove Shante to her apartment, where she revealed one more detail before they fell asleep: that she tried to get Mr. Biggs off of her car after she pulled over, but he was too heavy. After Shante awoke, she borrowed T's car and cell phone in order to locate Vaughn again. His real name is Cleet Jackson. She was able to get in contact with him on the phone, and the two arranged to meet at Cleet's grandmother's home. The two then drove to Shante's house, and on the way, she explained to Cleet that she had messed up real bad. She had hit a white guy, and he was still in her garage. Upon arrival to Shante's house, Cleet went into the garage and saw Mr. Biggs sticking out of the windshield. He then grabbed a rake and poked at Mr. Biggs, to see if he was still alive, but he didn't move. Cleet Jackson determined for himself that Mr. Biggs was deceased and came up with the plan of moving his body so that it could be found and the family could bury him. He called his cousin Tyrone for help in moving Mr. Biggs' body, which Tyrone agreed to do. Cleet and Shantae borrowed a car from Cleet's girlfriend in order to transport Mr. Biggs' body. Shantae retrieved a blanket from inside the house, and then two men wrapped Mr. Biggs' body in the blanket and put him in the trunk of the car. Shantae, Tyrone, and Cleet drove to Cobb Park, opened up the trunk, then Cleet and Tyrone removed Mr. Biggs and put him on the ground. The three then took off, taking the blanket with them to a nearby car wash, where they disposed of it. Gregory Glenn Biggs was born on August 16, 1964, in Texas, to Dell and Meredith Biggs. He married Tammy Biggs in 1982 after she became pregnant. They had one son, Brandon, who was born in 1983. A year later, Greg began showing signs of mental illness. Tammy was not prepared to deal with this, and the two divorced in 1984. Greg was eventually diagnosed with bipolar and mild schizophrenia, which he took medication for. Greg saw Brandon whenever he could. It was difficult because he was living in homeless shelters off and on. He ended up homeless due to helping a friend out financially and falling behind on his truck payments. He lost his job as a brick mason as a result and eventually lost his home. The director of the shelter he was staying at during the time of the incident, Kay Skaggs, stated that several weeks before Greg was killed, a letter arrived in the mail for him. Inside was a picture of a boy wearing a football uniform and asking his father to call him. She told Greg to call his son to let him know he was okay, and Greg did. Greg was described as handsome, hardworking, friendly, and caring. He liked to spend time with Brandon, and he always made sure he knew how much he loved him. Greg never lost hope that his life would get better. He had plans to run his own masonry business with a friend he met in a homeless shelter. The two lost contact for a time. Sadly, when this friend tried to get a hold of Greg in October of 2001 to discuss their business plans, he was unable to. Later on, he was saddened when he read about what happened to his friend in the newspaper. Todd Breedlove, a firefighter in Texas, finished his shift at 7 a.m. on the morning of October 27th. He was the only one there, so as he was locking up the gate, he was approached by two older gentlemen. These men informed Breedlove that there was a body in Cobb Park, and they believed that whoever it was dead. Breedlove drove the half mile to the park in his personal vehicle and spotted a white male down and, in his observation, deceased. He dialed 911 and, while doing so, made his way to the body. The body of Mr. Biggs was cold to the touch, he was not breathing, and there was no pulse. Brandon Biggs was a senior in high school at the time of his father Greg's death. He was left with the task of arranging the funeral. The funeral was held on October 31, 2001, in Dallas. Brandon and his girlfriend, his mother Tammy, Greg's sister, and Brandon's maternal grandparents were the only people that attended the funeral. After hitting Mr. Biggs with her car, Shantae ended up losing her job due to being unable to drive. Her electricity had also been turned off to her house. Because of these reasons, she lived with T until January, at which time Shantae was able to get another job. She ended up moving back into her home and even started dating a man named Derek. After months of no arrest and not being questioned about the incident, Shante must have felt she had gotten away with killing Mr. Biggs and disposing of his body. Around Valentine's of 2012, Shante and a group of friends planned on going out for the night. Shante mentioned to the friends that she was unable to drive, explaining that she had hit a man while intoxicated and high on ecstasy. It has been stated that she giggled while saying this. She also informed the women that she left the man in her garage while she had sex with her boyfriend, Terrence. She also stated that the two went into the garage and listened to the man's pleas for help. She told them how they waited until the man died, then disposed of his body at Cobb Park. Whether all of this is entirely true or not is not known. This is Shante's account as given to a group of friends, and it's possible that she embellished. One of the girls that was at the get-together was Miranda Daniel. Miranda was distressed by what she heard that night and visited her mother the next day and repeated to her what Shante had said. Miranda's mother implored her to call the police, and she did. The police were able to piece together who Shante was by what Miranda disclosed to them in the police call. On February 26, 2002, more than a dozen officers arrived at Shante's home with a search warrant. She answered the front door in her robe and broke down when she saw the officers. "I'm not a bad person," she was quoted as saying. "It was just an accident. It happened so fast. I've never even had a speeding ticket." The officers searched the garage and found the 1997 gold Chevrolet Cavalier. The seats had been removed, and in fact, a good portion of the interior was gone, as well as the windshield. They also noticed dark stains on the floor of the garage. Forensic officers were called to the scene, where they found blood and hair from the victim still lodged in the remnants of the car's windshield. Shante accompanied the officers to the police station and gave a statement. It differed from the account that Miranda Daniel gave. Shante initially claimed that someone slipped her the ecstasy tablet in a drink at the club. She denied having sex with her boyfriend while Mr. Biggs was stuck in the windshield of her car in the garage. Shante stated to officers that after Mr. Biggs was removed from the windshield, she couldn't go into her garage for days. She also told officers that she and Cleet removed the seats, burning the passenger one, in order to get rid of evidence. Both seats were found in her backyard. She was arrested that day for failure to render aid and was released on bond. A week later, she was arrested again, this time for murder. Her bail was set at $250,000. The trial for Shante Mallard commenced on June 23, 2003, and lasted until July 20th. Shante pled guilty to tampering with evidence and not guilty to murder. Cleet Jackson testified against her for a plea of guilty for tampering with evidence. Tyrone Cleveland got the same deal. He did not testify, but he did admit to his part in the crime. Cleet received a 10-year sentence, and Tyrone received 9 years. Talisi Fry, or T, also testified at the trial. She was a valuable witness for the prosecution for obvious reasons. It came out that while Shante was out on bond, they agreed on a certain story to tell law enforcement. T appeared before the grand jury several times and gave her account of the event. She also gave multiple statements to law enforcement. It was suspected that she wasn't being truthful when giving these statements. Although it is unclear about what exactly she wasn't being truthful about, I speculate that it is regarding whether Shante voluntarily took that ecstasy that night or not. The prosecutor's office also suspected that she was lying and was able to subpoena cell phone records that confirmed their suspicions. She admitted on the stand that she hadn't been truthful in the past to the police and prosecutors and stated that she was being truthful now. The prosecution brought in what looked like the entire interior of the car, including the seats, as evidence.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Brandon Biggs, Greg's son, took the stand and testified about the role his dad took in his life, which was mentioned earlier in the episode. Dr. Nizam Pirwani performed the autopsy on Mr. Biggs. He testified that Mr. Biggs had been lying face down for an extended period of time. He suffered no serious injuries to his vital organs, head, or chest area. He was also found to be in good health and not suffering from any life-threatening injuries. His left leg was nearly amputated from the knee down. Mr. Biggs ultimately died due to blood loss. All of the prosecution and defense witnesses agreed that he lived for 1 to 2 hours after being impaled. Had Gregory Biggs been given treatment within a proper period of time, Dr. Pirwani believed that he would have survived his injuries. The defense's argument throughout the trial was that Shante was so intoxicated and emotionally distressed, it rendered her incapable of making rational decisions. They also somewhat blamed her friends for leading her down the wrong path. The defense called their own medical examiner to testify, Dr. Vincent DeMaio. His claim, after viewing the autopsy report, was that Mr. Biggs had to have been knocked unconscious just from the impact of the windshield. His reason for believing this is because a windshield is designed to take a lot of force. And since Mr. Biggs' head hit the windshield, in all medical probability, he would have been rendered unconscious. He couldn't say whether he ever did regain consciousness, but he didn't believe he did. Both sides rested shortly after this. Moving into the penalty phase of the trial, Shante took the stand and testified for 2 hours before the sentence was handed down. The following are clips of Shante's testimony, which describes in her words what happened that night and her apology to Brandon. Following that, it's Brandon's testimony, where he addresses Shante and her family directly. Finally, a short clip of the judge handing down the sentence. Skip ahead about 10 minutes if you don't care to listen to these clips.
And as you were going around that curve, what happened?
As I was going around the curve, I hit Mr. Biggs.
Okay. And when you hit Mr. Biggs, did you see him before you hit him that you remember?
No, sir, I did not.
Okay. And what was the first thing that happened that made you know that you hit Mr. Biggs?
When I hit him, it was a real loud, very loud noise. And all this glass started flying in the car, followed by a lot of wind. And the glass was just cutting in my skin. It was just stinging me. But I really knew.
Did you know what happened first when you heard the sound and felt the glass?
No, I didn't.
Were you driving on the roadway when this happened?
Yes, I was.
When is the first time you realized that a body had come into your car?
Afterward, after the wind and everything, and I went ahead and exit Village Creek, I looked. That's when the first time I noticed.
So when you heard the sound and heard this and the crash, the glass was coming in, and then the wind from outside, and how far was it, do you think, to where you took the exit and saw you had a body in the car?
I can't be exact.
Do you have any idea how long it actually was?
I don't know, with seconds or a couple few minutes. I'm not exact. I really couldn't.
When you looked over, when you took the exit and you looked over and saw that there was a body in your car, just tell the jury the position that the body was in.
Mr. Biz came all the way inside of my car. He was, I never seen his face. He was like on the floor.
Which floor? Now, where on the floor?
On the passenger side of my car, like underneath the dashboard. And it's like one leg, it's like somewhat out the front glass.
And how much of one leg was outside the front glass?
Like at the crease of maybe the knee down.
Did the glass on the passenger side come in all the way?
Yes, it did.
What happened then?
I exited Village Creek and I made a left and I went over the overpass.
Okay. And you made a left at Village Creek?
Yes, I did.
And then where'd you go?
I made the first right on Martin Street, and I went up to the stop sign, and I stopped. I made that first right at the stop sign, and I stopped right there at the stop sign. And I got out the car.
Okay.
I sat in the car for a few seconds, and I got out the car. Oh. I was just screaming. And I got out the car. And I was just screaming, and I was crying. And I eventually walked around to the passenger side of the car.
Okay, when you walked around the passenger side of the car, what were you thinking?
That I seen a man's leg, and I didn't know what to do.
Okay, and what did you do?
I touched his leg.
How long did you touch his leg?
Oh, 1 quick second.
And what happened when you touched his leg?
I panicked even more and I started screaming. And then I just kind of cried and just started yelling.
Okay. And do you know how long you stood outside the car?
No, I don't.
Do you remember getting back in your car?
No, not really. No.
Did you start driving your car?
Yes. I stopped driving. Martin.
Okay. And did you eventually come to your street?
Yes, I did.
Do you know how long it took you to drive?
No, I don't recall.
While you were driving, did you hear any sounds from Mr. Big?
Yes, that was the first time I heard him. He moaned.
Have you seen what drugs have done to your life?
Yes, I have. They have destroyed my life.
Do you need treatment for drugs?
Yes, I want treatment.
You want to make sure you never get back on drugs again?
Yes, I do.
Tell me why. Tell the jury why.
Because I have ruined lives of other people. I have ruined my family's life. I have put people through pain. And I am so truly sorry. I am so sorry, Brandon. I am so sorry for what I have caused your family. And I am sorry for the pain that I have put my family through. And I'm also sorry for the harm I have done to society. I really am very Sorry.
And I'll ask the presiding juror, is this a unanimous verdict of the entire jury?
Yes, Your Honor.
In cause number 037152D, styled State of Texas versus Shantae Juan Mallard. Verdict form is to count one. We, the jury, having found the defendant, Shantae Juan Mallard, guilty of the offense of murder, assess her punishment at confinement in the Institutional Division of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for a period of 50 years, and in addition to such confinement, assess a fine of none. And we further do not recommend community supervision, signed by the presiding juror. Verdict form is to count two. We, the jury, having found the defendant Shantae Juan Mallard guilty of the offense of tampering with evidence, assess her punishment at confinement in the Institutional Division of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for a period of 10 years, and in addition to such confinement, assess a fine of none. And we further do not recommend community supervision, signed by the presiding juror. I believe we have an allocution.
Yes, Your Honor. Brandon Biggs would like to speak on behalf of the victim's family.
First of all, we would like to thank the jury. You've been so patient, and we would just like to say thank you. To the Mallard family, we would like to say that we're sorry for your loss as well, because there are no winners in a case like this. Just as we all lost Greg, you all will be losing your daughter. But while you will have phone calls and correspondence and visitation, we don't have these anymore. So in return, I would ask that you would guide Shantae and that you'd pray for her and that you'd protect her. But we'd like to say that we're sorry for your loss as well. To Shantae, I personally would like to say that I would accept your apology. But in return, I hope that you would accept my forgiveness. I hope you'll accept the forgiveness of Jesus Christ. While forgiveness is given, restitution is still required. So I ask that during your punishment, you'd seek the advice and the wisdom of your family and your loved ones so that you can live a productive life. Thank you.
The jury came back with a decision of 10 years prison time for tampering with evidence and 50 years prison time for murder. As the judge pronounced his sentence, Shantae looked down and quietly cried. Brandon Biggs and the rest of the Biggs family showed no emotion. Shantae's mother openly wept. She would be eligible for parole in 25 years, which means she's up for parole in 2027, as she got credit for time served. And with that, Shantae was led away to serve out her time at the Gatesville Prison in Gatesville, Texas. She was one that came face to face with a decision to make, and she went into the direction of what she felt served her best. She held the life of another person in her hands, and now she's paying the price for her actions. It's a much higher price than if she would have just shown humanity towards Gregory Biggs. Epilogue. Shantae filed an appeal in 2005. She and her attorneys argued that the evidence was legally and factually inefficient to sustain her conviction of felony murder. They went on to say that the state failed to prove that she committed an act dangerous to human life, that all they proved was an act of omission. The state contended that the evidence affirmatively demonstrated that Mallard did commit an act clearly dangerous to human life, the act of driving Mr. Biggs, bleeding and injured, to her house and hiding him in her garage caused his death. There were four other points that the defense argued, but the appeal was ultimately denied. Brandon Biggs received a $10,000 scholarship from a group called American Death Row Inmates for an essay he wrote on forgiveness that was specifically about Shante. This scholarship allowed him to graduate as a minister. Brandon is married now and has 3 children. He stated in an interview that he is reminded of his father daily and that people recognize him frequently. He named his son after his father and manages a hardware store. He filed a wrongful death suit against Shante that was settled out of court. Cleet Jackson and Tyrone Cleveland have both been released from prison for their part in the crime. Their incarceration was especially hard for their grandmother, Lou Dora Smith, who raised Cleet Jackson after his mother was murdered when he was 6. Cleet witnessed the murder. Shante's home was eventually sold. Shante is 44 now. She was 25 when the crime occurred. She had dreams of becoming a nurse, getting married, and having children. When she first went to prison, she had problems sleeping. It is said that now she is less troubled and has renewed her faith in God. She is still serving time in the Murray unit in Gatesville. Her projected release date is March 2052 at the age of 76. This case has been the inspiration for several TV shows and movies, including CSI Crime Scene Investigation, Anatomy of a Lie, 2002, Law and Order Darwinian, 2004, Fargo, Season 2, 2015, and the following movies, Stuck, 2007, Hit and Run, 2009, and Accident on Hill Road, 2009. Greg's mother, Meredith Biggs, 78, died September 26, 2017, in Greenville, Texas.
It never rains in California. The sun is always shining bright. People are smiling, making plans, hiding behind the shades, and you're doing the same.
Please stay a few moments longer and listen to a promo from a true crime podcast called Evidence of a Crime. I could write an entire episode on the hours upon hours of research, writing, and attention to detail that goes into this podcast, and just how much I love it. And maybe I will someday. But for now, I'll just let Fern speak for herself.
Hi everyone, I'm Fern from Evidence of a Crime, a true crime podcast. I use extensive research to respectfully tell the stories of missing people, unsolved, cold cases, murder cases, and more from around the world. I've covered well-known cases such as Jacob Wetterling, an 11-year-old boy who disappeared in the USA, but mostly cover lesser-known cases, such as the disappearance of Ruth Wilson, the murder of Carl Bridgewater, and the double murder of Monica and Dominique Frome. You can listen to Evidence of a Crime on all podcast platforms, or search Evidence of a Crime to find me on social media.
I'm so glad you decided to join me today on the 6th episode of Crimatorium. Episodes will be released bi-weekly on Monday mornings. If you have a minute, please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast, and consider becoming a patron of the show. All of Crimatorium's links are in the notes below, as well as other information about the show. All episodes are researched, written, edited, and narrated by me, Madeline.
Heart is fire, but baby, I bet you're cold without me, even when it's 90 degrees. Without me, I bet that you can get in and sleep in the bed, lying awake, cause I'm not there beside you, keeping you warm, and I know I bet you're...
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.